Samantha Irby's a writer who's not afraid to share very personal stories.
You would never confuse something I had written with something a PhD professor had written, ever. Never in life would you read one of my things and be like, you know what I think? Samantha Irby went to college. You would never think that by reading something I'd written, because I didn't. I dropped out.
We discuss her latest book and learn about her love for Zumba, Forrest Whitaker, and why she feels like her marriage has turned her into Al Bundy. Plus, thousands of commercial fishermen in Illinois work year-round to remove Asian carp from our waterways.
And it's just a lot of ducking and duking and jiving in the boat if you don't want to get hit. I've been hit in the temple and almost knocked out of the boat. I guess that's all part of the fun.
We speak with one of those fishermen and learn about a new species of black Asian carp that's particularly concerning and was just spotted for the first time near Peoria. That's all this hour on an Encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Here's a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. Chicago writer Samantha Irby just makes me laugh. And whether it's hilarity about her sex life, bathroom problems, or even when talking about her own painful childhood, her newest collection of essays covers it all. Sam also has a deal developing a television series with FX, all of it based on the writing of her first book, Meaty, and her very popular blog, Bitches Gotta Eat. That's being executive produced by Broad City's Abby Jacobson and Inside Amy Schumer's Jesse Klein. Her latest book, We Are Never Meeting in Real Life, just came out May 30th. It's already on the New York Times bestseller list. She's in studio with me now, Samantha.
Hi, Nyla.
Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. I'm so happy to see you. I love, like, seeing you.
Oh, it's great to see you, too. No, wait. Yes. I said Chicago writer. Is that fair? Because you were born in Evanston, and now you live in Michigan.
So people in Chicago.
Everyone in Chicago wants to claim you.
Yes,
still.
People in Chicago. They give you a hard time until you're successful, right? So when you're from the suburbs and you're like, I'm from Chicago.
They're like, no, you're from Evanston.
You're from Evanston. Don't know. Where? Where'd you grow up? Where's the best Herald? And then I'm like, okay, all right. I'm from Evanston. Now I say I'm from Evanston. And people in Chicago are like, what do you mean? We love you. This is your town. You're here. But now I live in Michigan. I can never say I'm from Michigan. I don't know enough about fruit or
do you know
other
the hand
Michigan
thing?
Things.
Do you know that how people from Michigan put their hand up and they say, "Are you doing that?"
No.
Okay,
I don't
so
know
you're
where
definitely
on
not.
The hand we
okay,
because
I went to college in Michigan, so I learned that.
Oh.
So the shape of Michigan is like your hand, and people from Michigan they just put their hand up and they point to the palm of their hand. Nobody's ever done this for you?
No.
Okay, you haven't been in Michigan long enough.
No, I haven't. It's almost a year. I can't even believe it's been. A year. A year is a long time to be away from a place. It's also a long time to be in a place that doesn't feel like you really live there. I keep waiting to, like, come back to my old apartment. I'm like, this experiment was fun, but I'm going to be back.
Getting married and moving to Kalamazoo was really
like this,
fun.
I mean, this was great and everything, but now I'm going to, like, go back home. But and everyone, when I came back, was like, welcome home. And I'm like, yeah, this is my home. But, like, I don't have anywhere to sleep here unless I pay to sleep there.
So well, it's I mean, not your right.
I mean, I guess that was the case when I had a place I lived here. But, like, my books aren't here and my stuff isn't here. And that's still hard for me. It's really hard.
One of the things I was also wanted to ask you about, and if this is hard for you, I've known you for a long time. Mm-hmm. I remember going to your lit readings on Tuesday nights, right? Were they
yep.
Tuesday nights? And
yep.
I love them. Now you're like you're a big deal. You're on the New York Times bestseller list. You have a TV series pilot development. I mean, you made it, girl. So is that weird?
It is. Well, so it's weird for people to say because I still feel like
it's not happening.
The exact same person. I think, like, if I were in New York or L.A., like, you know, looking out in L.A. at, like, palm trees and, like, drinking green juice or, like, in Manhattan, you know, I would feel like it was a bigger deal. But I am just in the corner of our living room. I don't even have an office. I have a place in the living room where my desk is where no one else is supposed to go. And, like, I mean, but you can see me when I'm working and, like, it doesn't look like a magical, exciting thing is happening. It's just basically me, like, sobbing, and it faces the wall. I'm like sobbing in the corner while trying to think of funny things to write. So I think if I were someplace else, it would feel...
If you had a fancy office.
If I had a fancy office in a fancy town that had, like, delivery laundry service and, like, groceries that you could order on your computer, then I would be like, yeah, I'm doing something. But now it's just like, you know, we go to Meijer, which is, like, the kind of grocery store where you can get, like, your... produce
and you can
car
buy a fish.
Battery.
And by a fish, I mean like a goldfish. I love
yes,
the pet section of
Meijer.
You can
get a carburetor. You can get shoes
carrots.
At the grocery store. Carrots. I think if my life were felt a little fancier, I would still feel fancy. But no, it's exactly the same. I'm still like folding laundry and trying to like watch Judge Mathis in the afternoon.
So I love that, by the way, you dedicated this book to Klonopin.
Yes.
I had to look up what that was. I had to Google it.
Are you kidding?
Oh, no.
You are like such a precious angel.
Precious angel.
You are. How are you? Oh, my God. So I, Klonopin, for two things. One, dedicating a book to a person is very hard because there's always some other person
who
thought
upset.
It should be dedicated to them. And so I wasn't going to dedicate it to my wife because, I mean, I just met her. And so I was, like, floating some ideas past her, and I could see her face getting more and more, her little frown going more and more down. So I was like, mm-mm, I will forevermore dedicate my books to inanimate objects. But, like, this was the year that I kind of came to terms. I would say over the last couple of years, I came to terms with being an anxious person who maybe could use some medical help. I had a couple panic attacks that I thought were heart attacks that weren't. And so
the whole point of a panic attack is it feels like a heart attack.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, until it happens to you, you're like, I can't ever imagine what that must feel like. And then it really feels like someone, well, for me, it felt like someone was like standing on my chest. While I couldn't stop thinking, I wasn't even scared of dying. I was, you know, dying would have been a relief. I was just sort of like replaying every awkward moment for the last 5 years.
Oh,
like,
that's awful.
I'm going to be a person who dies of this heart attack. And I can't stop thinking about, like, you know, the one time I said, I love you while hanging up the phone. You know, the mechanic or whatever, because it was automatic, you know? So those are the moments. I was just thinking of every dumb thing I've
so
ever
that,
done.
Hence why you dedicated the book to Klonopin.
Yes, it really helps. It really helps. I tried these doctors, but, you know, like they always start with the thing that doesn't involve medicine, right? So it was like, deep breathing, and then there's a style of breathing called 4-7-8 breathing, which you're supposed to try, where you inhale for 4, hold it for 7, and then push it out for 8. I could never push it out for 8. So then I would have a panic attack because I wasn't able to master the breathing. And finally, I was just like, you know, I went to the doctor and was like, girl, help me out. I was like, I don't need it all the time. But I am growing increasingly, like, more frazzled. And she agreed.
Finally.
She agreed. And then it has changed. I don't know that it has changed my life, but it has changed how stressful incidents feel to me, which is, like, incredible.
And so you have this incredible ability to take these very stressful incidents or these very sometimes traumatic incidents when you're talking about your childhood. But in this, when you write about them, they are really funny. So how long does it take for you to get to a point where you look back on something and you see some of the humor in it, if not all of it, and then you also write about it?
Yeah. Sometimes it's immediate. Like I told this story the other day at my mom's funeral, which was almost 20 years ago. At my mom's funeral, the minister kept calling her by my alive sister's name.
Aww.
And my sister sitting in the front row. And, you know, the first couple of times, it's, like, horrifying. And then,
and then kinda
like,
got funny.
The third time it happened, I just burst out laughing. And it, like, relieved some of the tension because everyone else was feeling it, too. And then we all just kind of started laughing. So in that moment, it was, like, immediate. And I do always, when something horrible happens, I do try to bounce back, at least outwardly, right away. Like, if someone sees me do something terrible, you know, like, terrible, I immediately try to make a joke so that we can both kind of, like, shuffle off and then think about it later in horror. Other things it has taken, I mean, there are some things that have taken like years. I've had like breakups and stuff where I'm like, man, that was not immediately funny to me. But usually like with enough time and perspective, I can like squeeze the jokes out of any situation. That is my best way to process things, is just to find the one nugget of it that's hilarious, or the one thing I can make funny and sort of and feel like I can give it to someone else to use to help them, because it can't just be happening to me. I
can hear the anxiety in your voice as you say that. It is not just happening to you. I feel like
it's not just happening to me, but I gotta be the one to talk about it, because not everyone can, right? I am lucky, if we could call it that, that I can sort of like spin this manure into comedy gold.
So can you please share in that vein, can you please just share the story of the Civil War reenactment that you encountered randomly at a wedding in Naperville?
Yes.
Can you tell everybody that story?
Yes. So I went to my friend's wedding in Naperville, which is a conservative church on every corner, kind of like, I think,
Chicago
super
suburb.
Republican Chicago suburb. And it's like a beautiful, it's a really beautiful town. I went with my friend who is like pretty, I mean, she looks like a teenage boy. If you see her, if she walked by you, you'd be like, look at that young man. And she's not trans or anything. She just, like, that's how she looks like Dennis the Menace a little bit. And so she.
Okay. That's a very clear picture for everybody.
Yes, yes.
So and you do not look like Dennis the Menace. For people who have not seen you.
I'm tall. I'm black. I shave my head. I'm like a big person. And so we are an odd pairing. And so I was like, Amy, come to this wedding with me. And she was like, okay. And she really did. She went. But she wore a dress, and she is not a person who usually wears a dress, and it was an ill-fitting, like, old prom dress. And, I mean, you can Dennis the Menace
in a prom
an
dress.
Ill-fitting prom dress. And then me, I looked just my normal thing, which is not that great. So we go to this wedding. I was super uncomfortable because all these, you know, like, people, like, who look really nice and look like they're relaxed really make me feel nervous, because I'm always, like, you know, like a hulking meat beast, like, blah, yeah. Like coming into this church, sweating into this church. We were so late. Okay, so there's the ceremony, and then we had like hours to kill before the reception, and I had not prepared for them. So I was like, let's just drive around. And in Naperville, I don't know if they still do it, but they have a thing called Civil War Days, and reenactors get together in this park, and they sort of like set up, like they recreate
a battle.
I am not sure. We missed the battle. I'm sure there is, but what we saw was just sort of the like downtime.
But did you see Confederate flags? Because
yes.
I would think, you know, as people, both of us are people of color. Confederate flags make me nervous. Like,
yes.
That's a sign of, like, I don't belong here.
Right.
That's what I think when
right.
I see.
Well,
and I grew up in the South, and I think that.
Yeah. It's, I was not like, hey, let's go join. But when we saw, so we first go by, and I see the flags, and I'm like, it doesn't really fit in with this town. Like, the town's, like, real cute and whatever, you know, and, like, I think those of us in the North, I sometimes, like, you forget, like, what's happening below I-80, right? Like, you forget that there are people who are still, like, clinging to the Confederate way of life. So we drove past, and I was like, ugh, what's happening there? But then we saw people in costumes with, like, muskets or whatever, like fake muskets walking around. And I was like, let's pull over, you know? And I carry a copy of my freedom papers with me, so I felt pretty secure.
They didn't think you were a runaway slave. That's good.
I was pretty secure walking around. We didn't go in the fence, but we did walk around. So can you imagine, though, how they felt? Because I was gawking at them like, look at these people. And then, of course, here we are, like me and Dennis the Menace in her dress. And like, it was like we all just stared at each other a lot. We tried to take
a lot of
pictures.
Did anyone talk to you? They did talk to you.
There was one woman who I said looked like Little Bo Peep or like Florence Nightingale. And she came up to us and she was like, I was wearing a necklace. And she was like, that's an interesting necklace. And I like couldn't believe that a person dressed the way she was. Like, and she didn't say interesting in like the, where did you get
it? She said it in a nice way.
Well,
or she said it in a mean way.
Yeah, she said it in the like, what is that kind of way. And I was like, that is awfully rich coming from you, Typhoid Mary. So... that was an amazing I love things like that because as a person who writes about awful things, I know a story when I see one and I was like, we got to get out of the car and unless they kill us, this is going to be a really incredible story. Unless I'm captured, this is going to be a really incredible story.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Samantha Irby. That story she was just sharing is in her latest book. It's called We're Never Meeting in Real Life. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. By the way, a longer version of this interview is going to be posted on our website, 21stshow.org. Stay tuned. We're going to return after this short break.
Support for The 21st comes from the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing tomorrow's leaders to be advocates for and agents of social change. More information at socialwork.illinois.edu.
This is an encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Samantha Irby. Her latest book is called We're Never Meeting in Real Life. It's a collection of essays that are just hilarious. A lot of the topic matter of which we really can't talk about on public radio, I should say. And I was
That's
searching.
That's going to make it sound so mysterious. I love it.
It sounds mysterious. It's a little salacious, like we'd say. Can I ask you about one story you wrote about?
Yeah.
I love your love of Zumba. And you know, Zumba was created in my hometown of Miami.
Yes.
The founder of Zumba. Why do you love Zumba?
Okay, first of all, I love Pitbull a lot.
Amen.
Mr. 305. I love Pitbull back
before
when
he was
wearing like jerseys and hats before
right.
he was like
before he was
suit
the Miami
tie.
Mogul, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I mean, I have a deep abiding love for Pitbull, and so the first class I went to, first of all, I am not the best dancer, but a lot of the people who go to Zumba are even worse dancers. So then I really felt like, I was like, oh man, I can like,
you were the shining
do
star.
These steps. I stood in the back though. I didn't like wear the coin skirt, you know, like there are the people who are really into it and have like the armbands and the
Zumba
workout
shoes.
Wear the Zumba shoes.
Yeah.
I'm not that deep into it, but like, I was like, I feel good doing this. I mean, I really like dancing, but also all of the songs are the kind of songs like I feel like I'm cool, right? Like I got a lot of like, you know, death tattoos and stuff, and I feel like I'm a cool, edgy person. So a lot of the Zumba songs are not things that I feel confident listening to in public, otherwise they will damage my reputation. But in Zumba, I can be like at the Y in an old ratty t-shirt and like sing Wepa, to that Gloria Estefan song,
yes.
to my heart's content. So I love it. I love it. Also, it's full of like moms, and I love me a mom, like getting her groove back in Zumba. Like, that's my oxygen. So I really love it. I do.
Sam, I wonder, you said something at Printers Row Lit Fest that I was a little surprised at. You're friends with Roxane Gay, the writer.
Yeah.
Also was in Illinois for some time, for folks who know Roxane Gay. Quite, you know, she's you know what I would say, a very modern American voice. Mm-hmm. Not that you're not a modern American voice, but you said people confuse you too? Because you're two black women who write?
Yeah.
Is it really that?
I mean, I don't know what else it could be. We're both large black women.
Who write about very different things.
Yeah. So, like, the writing part, you would never confuse something I had written with something a PhD professor had written, ever. Never in life would you read one of my things and be like, you know what I think? Samantha Irby went to college. You would never think that by reading something I'd written, because I didn't. I dropped out. So it's got to just be the visuals, except I shave my hair and I wear giant glasses, and like Roxane is really like sweet and soft spoken. And if you see me, I'm always like cracking a joke and like swearing and being really inappropriate. But people
confuse her. Have people gone up?
Yes. She tweeted me that she was at a reading and someone stood up and asked her a question at her own reading about something I had written. She was like, so in that one piece about diarrhea, and Roxane's like, no, that's not me.
That's Samantha's territory.
That's not me. And then I feel bad for, so when people confuse me for her, I'm like, you think I'm smart, huh? Okay. But then when she tells me that people confuse her for me, I just feel really bad because, you know, I write a lot of terrible things and I don't want her to have to answer questions about these awful things that I've written.
So is it a little strange now to sort of adapt to this way of being? Of, I remember when I first interviewed you, you had your day job at the animal hospital.
Yep.
It was always really hard to schedule you because you were always working. I'd be like, I want this girl to come on and talk about her blog, but she has a day job and she cannot come on my afternoon
show.
Too
busy scheduling cat dentistry.
Is it, because does that also change the writing? Was the writing process for this book different than Meaty, your first book, or what you do for your blog?
Well, I miss having a job for a lot of reasons. One of them, it's just when you're working with the public all the time, there's no shortage of insanity to fuel the fire.
And your cat,
yes.
Helen Keller.
Yes.
Her cat, everyone should know that you're... I'm sorry, by the way, that Helen Keller is no longer with us.
Thank you. She had a long, good life and good... Not good riddance, but it was time. It was a good time to part ways with living for her. People do not want to hear about this cat. Read the book and you'll see like my journey.
Can you give
us
a 30-second version of Helen Keller?
Yeah, of course. So
the cat. I feel like you should keep saying so everyone knows that's the name of the cat.
Yeah.
That you picked, not me. Yeah. Just to put the inappropriate on you.
Yeah, I'll take it. I deserve it. One of the doctors at the clinic found a stray newborn kitten under his porch. He brought her to work. She, at the time, had a big tumor in her ear, and she had her third eyelids were closed over her eyes, so the technicians named her Helen Keller. But they fixed her up. They didn't get her all the way fixed, but because she had these problems, we didn't want to give her to a normal person who wasn't prepared to deal with the cost of caring for a sick animal. So somehow she ended up with me. I think it was just like, Sam doesn't have any pets, make her take it. And I was like, oh, what? So I took her home. She was awful. She bit, she scratched, she lunged, she glowered. I mean, she tore everything up. She sneezed like bloody snot all over everything. It was really, I mean, it was a hard goodbye, Helen. No, I'm just kidding. But we couldn't do that to a normal person, like a nice person who wanted a cat. So they gave her to a mean person who was ambivalent about having a cat. And somehow I got her to live for like 8 years. She wasn't supposed to live. But, you know, evil
fuels evil,
I guess.
So maybe it was actually your loving kindness?
That is a stretch for what I did for her. My pouring food in a bowl and taking her occasionally to get checked out. That was the most I did, and she somehow thrived. I mean, who can but I still can't believe it.
Is Helen Keller going to be in the TV series?
Yes. So the show is going to start like 10 years ago when I was like kind of.
When you were single.
Yeah.
Had a lot more exploits that end up in the book.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. We're going to play all those out. I have a lot of revenge to get on people I used to date. So they're going to be all
because
over
do
TV.
You get to do revenge casting?
I mean, I don't even know. I don't know yet. I'm not going to be in it. But like, I feel like if we get some love scenes, if I pick some hot people, I'll get to like practice first with them to show them how I would do it. Yeah, that's my plan. I mean, they gave me executive producer. What can I do? I mean, I got to be able to do something with that.
So I have this is my question I've been dying to ask you.
Yeah.
Is Forrest Whitaker going to be? Because I know. Can you?
I love him.
I know you love Forrest Whitaker.
I do. Everyone, I love Forrest Whitaker.
Can you explain why you love him
so much? Yes. He is so tender, so sweet. He's so sensitive. He, like, is a really good actor. He, like, I mean, his roles, roles where he's tough, you can see he's, like, a sweetheart underneath. And he has a foundation that does amazing work. And, he has a great voice. I love him. So I've written several odes declaring my love for him. I don't ever want him to get creeped out, but
so how many odes is creeping out? I think more than three might be it.
No, okay. I wrote one on my blog and then one that was published, I think, on The Toast. Yeah. The Toast used to have a series called If Blank Was Your Boyfriend, and they let me write one for, like, if Forrest Whitaker was your boyfriend, like, things you could imagine happening. And so I wrote that, and when it came out, I tweeted it at him, but I got no response. And then I was like, Forrest is too pure for Twitter. Anyway, like,
he's, maybe he doesn't even manage his own Twitter account.
He's super famous. He doesn't do that. But I don't know if I have an agent in L.A. I feel like if they let us make the show, somebody has to make the call for him to do like a guest appearance. I would die. I'll let you know when it's happening so then you know you're never going to talk to me again because I will be dead if that happens. And I don't know that he gets as much recognition as he should. I feel like he's like my Denzel.
Forrest is your Denzel.
Yeah.
Do you want him? Is that the name of the title of your next book?
Yes. Forrest Whitaker is my Denzel.
I think you just say Forrest is my Denzel.
Well,
I wouldn't even
know.
Go with last names.
Okay.
Well, then hopefully at that point people would have learned a little bit more about him, right?
Yes.
So I have something to disclose to you. Bathroom things make me really uncomfortable talking about publicly.
Yeah.
You talk about this publicly all the time.
Yeah.
It just never bothered you. You have, well, as well documented in your writing, irritable bowel syndrome.
Is this
how it's just been, as you said before, you try to find humor in every situation?
Yes. So it's pretty funny to me. So
even there are words that I don't even like to say.
Okay. I won't make you say them. I won't. I promise. So when I was first like sort of like going through the like diagnostic process, I was like, I mean, some of the stuff you have to do is just really hilarious. I did this one thing called a capsule endoscopy where you swallow a capsule with a camera in it and it takes pictures like all
as it's going
the way,
down you?
Yeah, as it's going down you wear like a transmitter and it sends pictures to this
thing.
Does
it
like,
make noise?
That, no.
Oh.
No, you can't hear. And then eventually it comes out and then that's it. Then all of the information is in the transmitter and then they can see a picture. And it's like, how can I not talk about that? Because it's funny to me and someone else can maybe use this information. Why not? And also when I started making jokes about it, like, so I was in the throes of like trying to date and meet people. There was no way to get to know someone without really being honest because when you're spending the night or when you're going to dinner and you don't know what's going to be in the thing you ordered that you think might be safe to get you through at least tonight, you know, I've had those days where I'm like, yeah, I'll get the thing and like not realize there's cheese on it. And then they're like, hey, want to come back to my place? And then it's like, what do I do? And so for me, it was either like always politely decline, or it was like, yeah, I'll come over and at 3 a.m., you're going to hear a lot of flushing, you know? And then like,
you're going to hear a lot of flushing.
I'm going to run
the
shower.
Is that what you say? You're going to hear a lot of flushing.
Yeah. I'm going to run the shower and you're going to be like, is this strange person taking a shower in my apartment? And no, it's just going to be, I don't want you to hear, you know, it's going to be a medical situation and I don't want you to hear that.
So, can I ask, now that you're married and living in Michigan, do you worry that you're not, because you don't have the exciting single life, the racy single life we were just talking about? Do you worry about more material? Is that something you think about? Or is this just, I do feel like you have Samantha Irby has a unique outlook on life, and you have situations that come to you that, no matter where you are.
It's a little bit of both. So there's a little bit of like, you know, meeting new people means you get to make fun of new people if that's like what you do. And so I'm not meeting a lot of new people who say wild things to me that I then can like turn into jokes or like, you know, put me in weird situations. But I do have a wife now who's
lovely.
Very irritating.
Lovely. As I know your wife. But go ahead.
Who does a lot of things that drive me crazy. And she has two children. So I'm around kids half the time. I feel like I've only been there a year and I already have like a lot of material. Like the kids, I sort of make a, like, if I hear them fighting, I'm like, you know, kids, get in here. And, you know, they'll come in like, uh-oh.
Oh, because you want to record their fights.
And I record the fights. I'm like, hold on. Do you, places, and then I record them fighting and then play it back and laugh. I feel like it's
That's
just...
great parenting.
Well, see, that's what I'm not, I always say, like, parents get to decide on, like, the vaccines and colleges and schools. I don't make any of those decisions. So I tell the kids, I'm like, you know, I'm not your parent. I'm like your mom's wife. And I'm just sort of living a parallel life alongside you two. So I'm going to write a book called Detachment Parenting about...
After Forrest is the New Denzel, you're going to write about detachment.
Look, we're writing all my
great.
Future books. No, I feel like... They provide a lot of comedy. And so, like, I'm not really going to write about them as people because I feel like that's a choice they get to make, like, whether or not they want to be. And they're too young to be like, yes, put me in your book. But my reactions to them, like, I just am getting more and more ornery. There's always someone in our house, always. There is always a tiny child, you know, streaking past me, up my stairs, down the stairs, out the front door. And, like, I am learning a lot about myself. I also have never really existed within a family unit before, and I hate it a lot. You know, like, she never lets, like, my stuff just be. I'm like, it's turning me into, like, Al Bundy, which, I mean, is maybe going to be my next book after the detachment parenting, is how I turned into like a mean television dad.
How you turned into a mean angry white man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because I'm always like, if I leave my shoes right there, I know where they are. And then when I need them again, they're right there. But then you come along and you put the shoes away and I don't know your system of putting things away. And there's a lot of material there, I think, just in my gripes of living with a nice person who likes to clean up after me. I'm a really terrible person. I sound like a bad person.
And you can read all about it in her amply titled, We Are Never Meeting in Real Life, which is just out. Samantha Irby. Sam, it's been great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. You've probably heard about Asian carp. They're an invasive fish species that can eat up to 20% of their body weight in one day and grow up to 100 pounds. And they also can be devastating to our native fish populations. Recently, a new species of Asian carp has been found in Illinois. Officials at the Department of Natural Resources reported in April that a black carp was caught in the Illinois River south of Peoria, more than 100 miles north of where the species has previously been recorded. The department has been calling on help from commercial fishermen and the public to identify and capture this Asian carp before they do irreparable damage to native wildlife in Illinois. To learn more about this, I'm joined now by Dan Stevenson. He's chief of fisheries at the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. On the line with us as well is fisherman Sean Price. He's based in Fulton, is actually out in the water right now in Yorkville. Sean, are you about 60 miles southwest of Chicago. Are you trying to capture Asian carp right now?
Yes. Actually, I'm currently in Lake Calumet, so I'm much closer to the city.
Oh, okay. So you're pretty close to the city of Chicago. And I should say, Dan from DNR, welcome to the 21st, too. Thanks, Dan. Welcome back. Thanks for being with us as well.
Sure, Nyla. Glad to be here.
So, Sean, you are out catching fish. Have you? How often do you encounter Asian carp when you're out in the water?
Well, it kind of depends on where we're at. Up here in Lake Calumet, the plan is to never find another one, but it's part of our monitoring program to spend time up here each year looking for them, making sure they're not here. So this is one of our big events. We have a couple a year. This is one of the big events where we put a lot of manpower, a lot of equipment, in an effort to try to catch one, and hopefully we do not. And so far, we have not encountered any this week.
Sean, I'm going to ask you about all of that manpower and equipment in a second, but Dan, can you explain, there's actually four different species of Asian carp that have now been found in Illinois waters, is that correct?
That's correct. And some of the, when I go on Facebook, some of the social media and stuff, I see that people don't really understand, they don't really realize when we talk Asian carp, we're actually lumping four different species. The grass carp, that eats underwater vegetation that's rooted in the bottom and grows up in the underwater. There are also the two plankton feeders, the silver carp, those are the ones that jump, and the bighead carp, they're a plankton feeder too. They don't jump, but they can get really big. They're the ones that can get up to the 100 pounds you mentioned. The biggest one we ever collected was 82 pounds. The newest fish that we hadn't seen in Illinois much before at all was the black carp. They eat mussels, and mussels are, of course, real important to the ecosystem for filtering water, cleaning the water, important in improving water quality. So, and in Illinois, I don't know exactly how many species of mussel we have, but close to half of them are endangered or threatened, either state or federally listed. So we're concerned about the black carp. Our commercial fishermen are really the ones, there are more than 1,000 of them within the state, so they're kind of our eyes in the rivers and streams throughout the state. So if they happen to see a black carp, they contact us. If it is verified as a black carp, they get a $100 bounty. Sean is working on part of the program, and he's one of the contracted fishermen through the DNR that we hire. And he's actually above the electric barrier now, and that's why he mentioned he hopes they don't find any, because he is a couple times a year, we actually put some real intensive efforts above the electric barrier to see if there are any up there. Most of the time, our commercial fishermen working with our biologists are below the electric barrier in the Marseilles, Starved Rock, and Dresden Island pools. And that's kind of the leading edge of the invasion of the Asian carp. And in this situation, when I say Asian carp, I'm talking about silvers and bighead.
You're talking about the silvers. Danielle, can you remind folks where the electric barrier is right now?
The electric barrier, there's three of them actually online, and they're in Romeoville. They're just up the cause, we call it the Chicago Area Waterways, just upstream from Joliet, 10 miles or so. And there are three electric barriers there, and a fourth one is coming online in January. So we'll have four different electric barriers on this waterway trying to keep the Asian carp from getting into Lake Michigan. And actually, if you look at where we're finding them, we're finding most of them 15 to 20 and all the way down to Starved Rock, which is about 100 miles below Lake Michigan. So,
where did you find the black carp, and how many have been caught so far?
In Illinois, we've had 57 reported as all, not the tens of thousands or millions that we find of the other species. And of those 57, 49 of them, I believe, were in the Mississippi River in the St. Louis area. We found some right at the mouth of the Illinois River where it drops into the Mississippi, and then we found this one up closer to Peoria. So that's kind of the farthest north migration. That's kind of why we put the news release out, and just to let people know we're looking for them to kind of monitor their upstream migration.
So what does it look like, and how does the bounty work, Dan?
Well, they look a lot like the grass carp. That's probably their closest cousin, I guess you'd say. They look like the grass carp, but they've got they're a darker black color. They don't really, in my mind, look like any other native species, although we have people calling in saying they found them. And actually, they send us pictures of freshwater drum and buffalo and a blue sucker. We got a picture of a blue sucker yesterday and common carp. So there's a lot of misidentification out there. So in order to get the $100, it has to be verified by us that, yes, indeed, it is a black carp.
Sean, have you ever seen a black carp?
I have seen pictures of them. I have never personally seen one or caught one.
And many people have heard of the silver carp, right? Those are the ones that can jump, as we were talking about, 8 to 10 feet in the air. I know that you got to be careful when you're catching those, right? Because you can get pretty injured, especially if you got this very heavy fish jumping at you. Sean, how do you see and catch those carp without getting hurt?
Luck more than anything.
I was going to say, were you going to say very carefully? Right.
Yeah. No, I mean, no, we don't do anything extremely carefully. You can't catch them if you do that. But typically, you know the speed. I mean, we're good at what we do, and, you know, we know what we can do to activate them to get them to really start jumping. And in that case, we'd be going slower, and it's just a lot of ducking and juking and jiving in the boat if you don't want to get hit. But yeah, you can definitely take some off wrong spots of the body, and I've been hitting the temple and almost knocked out of the boat. I guess that's all part of the fun. I'm up here to do a job, and
you got to be careful too, though, right? When you say activate them, how do you get them to? Are you just sticking? I mean, when you say activate, I think, are you sticking poles in the water? What are you doing to get them to jump?
No. So if you know where they're at, you can just ease in on them with your boat motor and then kind of lift the motor out of the water and rev it up real loud as you're moving, and that makes them all blow up, start jumping everywhere. So if you get in the middle of a school and then make a bunch of noise with the motor, it activates them. If you get into bigger schools of them out on the water, you just drive your boat like half speed or quarter throttle, and they'll just all be jumping behind the boat then. So you can either make them jump in the boat or let them jump behind you.
Okay. Do you have any idea, Sean, how much silver Asian carp you guys have caught?
In total or this
year? Yeah, in total. Well, let's just go with this year, maybe. Let's just go with this year.
I don't know what we're up to this year. We got to be at least over the 200,000 mark for sure, and it could be double that. I'm lucky I don't have to keep track of them numbers. I know what we catch per week.
Dan,
I know we were over 1 million pounds last year. So.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, over 1 million pounds. Dan, what does that represent, though, in terms of what we know is already in the waterways?
Yeah, we don't really know any total numbers. There's studies have been done down in the Peoria pool, and it's shown that just on the silver carp, that one species, they had 13 tons per river mile. And so if you figure big heads are roughly the same, I mean, that's just an incredible amount of poundage. And that's why we keep in the Morris area where we put in at, that's why we keep trying to knock back that leading edge, just to keep them from moving upstream any farther. And this is the sixth year of our program with the contracted commercial fishermen and our biologists, and they've taken out over 5 million pounds that have been sent to a processing plant to be turned into liquid fertilizer.
And
so we just keep knocking it back. I know there are some people that question, you know, in the Dresden Island pool, we've reduced their numbers by about two-thirds. And that's the farther upstream. That's the pool below Joliet.
So you feel like it is making a difference, because some people might think this is, I don't want to say a drop in the bucket, but I mean, it sounds like in some cases you feel like you are pushing back the population a bit.
We do. We feel like that. If you look at the Dresden Island, and we've reduced it by about two-thirds. So summers, I see, again, we get some letters on Facebook, and we get other different social media, and other people have contacted us too. Well, why don't you've knocked them down back by two-thirds, so what's the point in continuing? Well, we kind of talk about it like mowing your yard. You mow the yard in the spring one time, you don't just quit. You got to keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And the same thing, we just keep hitting them hard at their leading edge. And by leading edge, I'm talking about the leading edge of their migration upstream. And we just keep knocking it back with our contracted fishermen and our biologists working on that. And we are, the plan is to keep them out of Lake Michigan. That's why we're putting so much effort there. We don't want them in the Great Lakes.
Right. That's Dan Stevenson, Chief of Fisheries with Illinois DNR. Sean Price is on the line with us as well. He's a commercial fisherman. Sean, so you said you're up near Calumet. So you're past the electric barrier. You're pretty close, you know, outskirts of Chicago. You said that you're doing some, what are you doing now? I imagine you said there's a lot of equipment. You guys are searching. And I'm particularly thinking about what Dan was telling us about the other kind of carp that's kind of their bottom feeders. They're down there at the bottom. How are you checking for those?
What we're doing, working with the DNR, the nets we use, so all the gear we use, all the crews we have, we're all have the capability and do fish different gears, and they're all capable of catching all four species of Asian carp. So any gear we're using can catch a black carp, can catch a silver, a big head, a grass carp.
And by the way, I was going to say, and with Sean here being on the phone, these people, these contracted commercial fishermen that we have hired to do this are the best in the business. That's why we've hired them. They're just super good at finding them, super good at netting them, and they don't mind working really, really hard to get these fish out. Again, they've taken over 5 million pounds out in and this is the sixth summer that they've worked on it. So they're taking out a lot of fish right at the leading edge of the migration.
Yeah, Sean, we're glad you're out there. Dan, really quickly for everybody, remind everyone about this $100 bounty for the black Asian carp.
Yeah, what happened last week was we started getting people. The $100 bounty got out there in a couple of newspaper articles, and it was out on social media, and so we had people starting to send in pictures and telling us they want their $100, and again they were sending in pictures of anything but the black carp. So they're not going to bite on a hook and line. So hook and line fishermen aren't going to see them. It will be the commercial fishermen that see them, just like it was 25 years ago. The commercial boys that are out there fishing were the first ones to see the silvers and the big heads too. They'd come to us and they said, "What's this fish?" Well, it was the early migrators, the early invaders. And so that's why we're using the commercial fishermen to have a look for the early invaders of the black carp, and we're offering them $100 if they actually do find one, because that way we'll know the location of the fish. We can tell the fish's age from the scales. We can tell really actually where it's spawned from by the bones, the amount of calcium and strontium in the ear bones that they have. Fish have a bone in their ear called an otolith, and we can kind of tell where they respond from just based on that too. So we get a lot of information. If they find one, they can give it to us. They put them on ice, contact us, and then we'll go out and have a look at it.
Dan, really quick, we're almost out of time, but can you remind us that the black carp then, is it sort of the same thing, the black Asian carp, as the other Asian carp, how it ended up? Because I think people who may not know the story are like, how did all of this get in our waterways?
The four species were actually brought in the 70s into the southern part of the country, down in Mississippi and Arkansas, into the aquaculture ponds down there. They raise fish, catfish in particular, down in those states for the market. And these fish help clear the water, keep the water clean and all that. So it was a water quality thing. They were allowed to be brought into the United States, and they escaped. And then we had the big flood in 93 of the Mississippi River, the Mississippi, Ohio, Illinois, and all that. And they really expanded their range in and began their migration upstream. And now, of course, they're all over. And the Illinois River is just the perfect spot for them. It's really a fertile river, which means a lot of food for them. And they've done very, very well in the Illinois River. That's kind of how it started, though. They were brought in for the aquaculture industry in the 70s.
We will tweet out a picture of the black Asian carp. As Dan Stevenson is saying, this is something more that commercial fishermen like Sean Price, who have been with us, will be seeing. But just so everyone's aware of what they look like, I want to thank Dan Stevenson, Chief of Fisheries with Illinois DNR. Sean Price as well, joining us from his boat where he's out today near Chicago. Sean, thanks for being with us. Dan, thanks as well.
Thanks. No problem. Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play the 21st. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montesilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.